From Ridgeway to Warminster, Pittston to Carlisle, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, a blue wave crashed over the Philadelphia suburbs on Election Day, but a red wave washed over southwestern Pennsylvania. Leo Knepper from the Citizens Alliance of Pennsylvania is here to review the election results. Abandoned properties that end up being owned by municipalities is a major problem, especially in the state's larger cities. Frank Gamrat and Eric Montardi dive into the issue on this week's Allegheny Institute Report. And clearing the way to take advantage of telemedicine technology is one way to cut the cost and improve the quality of health care. Ashley Klingensmith of Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania has this week's Lincoln Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to Leo Knepper in just a couple of minutes, but first, here are news headlines from patownhall.com. As the dust settles on the 2019 general election, counties across Penn's Woods are scrambling to comply with Governor Tom Wolf's order requiring all voting machines used in the 2020 elections to have a paper backup to their electronic tabulations. For most counties, this means purchasing new voting machine systems, and the cost of doing that is steep. Some help is on the way, though, as $90 million in state funding was approved as part of a package of election reforms signed into law last week. In what could be a bad omen, York County's system suffered from what state Republican Party officials termed massive machine malfunctions in Tuesday's election, heightening concerns over the implementation of new voting machines in a high turnout presidential election year. Results of the fall 2019 Keystone Business Climate Survey were released this week by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research. The semi-annual poll of business owners and chief executive officers found that the state's economy has cooled somewhat over the past year, but it remains strong. The biggest problem facing Keystone State employers is finding enough qualified individuals to fill available jobs. That problem has moved ahead of high taxes and excessive regulation in vexing employers. Generally speaking, the business leaders who responded to the survey say the Trump administration has the nation's economy on the right track, with 60% holding that view compared to 29% who say the economy is on the wrong track. You can see complete results of the survey at lincolninstitute.org. The Commonwealth of Pennsylvania has $47 billion in debt, according to the state's independent fiscal office. This is the seventh highest state debt load in the nation. The Center Square reports that State Representative Andrew Lewis of Dauphin County has introduced legislation that would lower the limits on adding new debt, primarily through the state's Redevelopment Assistance Capital Program. Known as RCAP, the program is designed to provide funding for local construction projects, but in practice, it has become a veritable slush fund for lawmakers looking to give grants to favored projects in their districts. Lewis says his legislation is needed to rein in that spending, which has increased dramatically in recent years. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. Democrats seized control of county governments in the Philadelphia suburbs in Tuesday's elections, but Republicans evened the score by taking control in several western Pennsylvania counties. For a look at the election results and what they might tell us about next year's presidential and statewide elections, we turn to Leo Knepper. Leo is Chief Executive Officer for the Citizens Alliance of Pennsylvania, or CAP. Leo, welcome back to Lincoln Radio Journal. Leo, another election is in the books, and let's start out with what happened statewide. There was only one race, and that was for two seats on the state superior court. You want to tell us a bit about the candidates and the outcome of that race?
Sure. So for the state superior court, the way essentially that it's set up for folks who don't pay too close of attention to it, it's the Superior Court itself is actually an intermediate appellate court, so it's the step below the Supreme Court. This time around, there were four candidates on the ballot for Superior Court, two Republicans and two Democrats. At the end of the day, the Democrats won one of the seats and the Republicans won the other seat. As far as who the candidates were who won, interestingly enough, the candidate who won for the Democratic Party, Dan McCaffrey, is the brother of a ousted Pennsylvania Supreme Court judge. But this judge also accepted $160,000 in PAC contributions from IBEW Local 98, which is Philadelphia Electrical Workers Union, whose boss, Johnny Doc Dougherty, happens to be under federal investigation and will be going in federal indictment for essentially racketeering charges. So that's an interesting campaign contribution. And then he also received $500,000 in contributions from the Trial Lawyers Association in Philadelphia. So it is unlikely that he is going to be someone who practices judicial restraint when it comes to looking at civil liabilities and things of that nature.
And the Republican winner was Megan McCarthy King.
Yep. And Ms. McCarthy King is a – or was a district attorney, I believe.
Assistant district attorney
in the southeastern part of the state. Really, it's interesting when you take a look at what the results kind of portend. When it comes to judicial races, this just really reinforces the fact that the people who win in these statewide judicial contests, it's really about geography. The two successful candidates came from the southeastern part of the state. The third place candidate came from the southwestern part of the state. She was a Democrat. Interestingly, she was rated as unqualified by the PA Bar Association and still managed to come in third just because she was from the, you know, Allegheny County, Pittsburgh area. And then fourth place, fourth place candidate came from central Pennsylvania, where, not surprisingly, that there's just not a lot of geographic population. Mm-hmm. And a lot of votes really for judicial stuff are cast absent really any solid information about candidates. It's just based on, you know, what county they're from.
That was, as I mentioned, the only statewide race. Now, there were all across the Commonwealth a wide range of county-level offices, county boards of commissioners. Counties, generally speaking, have three-member boards. There are some home rule counties that have a council executive. There are only a handful of those. But these three-member boards of commissioners were up in counties all across Pennsylvania this past week. And as we look at the results, Leo, it looks like the areas that were trending blue or trending Democrat continued that trend, and the areas that were trending red or Republican also continued that trend. So let's start in the Philadelphia suburbs. What were the results at the county level there?
At the county level in the Philadelphia suburbs, it was really just, as we've seen, the Democrats are consolidating power, where you saw the Democrats actually pick up Delaware County, the commissioner's offices, and that was a very contentious race as far as the Republicans were concerned.
So we saw that with Democrats taking control of boards of commissioners in Chester County, in Bucks County. They already had control in Montgomery County. As you mentioned, took control of county council in Delaware County. But if you go across the state to the western part of the state, we saw Republicans taking control in former Democrat strongholds, for example, Fayette County.
Yeah, I don't think Fayette County's had a Republican majority since Reconstruction. Yeah. So it's been a very long time.
Westmoreland Board of Commissioners also flipped to Republican. Now, it had been Republican 8 years ago. It went Republican for the first time, like Fayette, since the 1930s. Democrats took control again 4 years ago, but now Republicans swept back into office.
Yeah, and I think you're going to see a little bit of back and forth in some of these areas just because local races are a little bit – they're a slightly different animal because you have folks really kind of looking at name ID, who someone is as far as a member of the community. So there's going to be a little bit of back and forth in it, but you're not going to see – a lot of, okay, so they're just – you know, Republican for now, and then they'll go back to being solid Democrat for the next 30 years.
Right.
It just doesn't look like that's what's going to happen.
And some of the counties that are outside those immediate areas, for example, Berks County had a Republican sweep. So we haven't seen that blue wave that's taken over the Philadelphia suburbs really move too far out of there. Lancaster County, of course, remained Republican, although it's becoming much more competitive in Lancaster County than it had been. Another interesting fact, I don't know if you noticed, in Philadelphia, the city council, there is a mandated, I believe, two or three at-large seats that have to go to the minority party. And In Tuesday's election, for the first time, the minority, one seat was won by a Republican, but another was won by a socialist progressive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's not surprising. I mean, when you look at the Republican Party in Philadelphia in particular, it's a shell.
Mm-hmm.
So at this point in Philadelphia, the people are really choosing, you know, who's going to give us the most free stuff.
Well, in which case, vote socialist, right?
Right, exactly. It's also worth kind of pointing out, too, the southeastern part of the state and the collar counties outside of Philadelphia, where historically there really hasn't been a lot of difference between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party in terms of the policies that they're supportive of. It really appears that if someone wants to vote for a Democrat, they're just going to vote for a Democrat, and the Republicans aren't really doing anything to differentiate themselves.
Interesting you would bring that up, because last year in legislative elections, Republicans took a wipeout in the collar counties around Philadelphia. A number of state senators lost their seats. There was, almost a dozen state Republican House members who lost their seats. And all these folks were what a lot of folks would term rhinos.
Yeah, they were allied with what would traditionally be big government special interest groups. They were very friendly with organized labor, both in the private and the public sector. They were very, what I would, I guess, term socially progressive for the most part. So, and their inability to kind of articulate a limited government kind of free market message, it certainly didn't help them. And the unions did not stay out of it or decide to help their Republican allies. It's you know, they went in and backed the Democrats.
In the county of York, they had what the Republican State Committee is calling a major voting machine malfunction, which seems to be accurate because they weren't able to tabulate a lot of the ballots. They have a new voting system down there. The governor, Leo, has required all counties in Pennsylvania to have voting machine systems that have a paper backup. You may recall after the 2000 election, it was like, well, we don't want paper, we want electronics.
Right.
Now we don't want electronics, we want paper. So you're going to have, 40, 45 counties implementing new voting systems next year. And we saw this misfire in York County. Is this really creating the potential for a major meltdown with our count next year?
With all of the new voting machines coming online and there not really being a solid test election before that, like a low turnout election to work out the kinks, in a lot of places it can be a disaster next in 2020 when it comes to the presidential cycle, where you are going to be looking at historically high turnouts for a variety of reasons. Pennsylvania can really end up with a black eye. This is a problem that is going to be of Governor Wolf's own making.
Well, we'll see how that turns out. We have been talking with Leo Knepper from the Citizens Alliance of Pennsylvania. Leo, tell us just a bit about CAP and where can folks go online to learn more?
CAP, really between our educational efforts and our political action committee, are really an accountability mechanism in Harrisburg. We get involved with through our PAC primary and general elections. Our educational efforts include a scorecard. We try and keep track of what's happening in Harrisburg legislatively. If folks want to learn more about us, I would encourage them to visit our website at www.empowerpa.org or check out our Facebook page. We have a lot of lively discussions that occur there as well.
Yes, we do. Leo Knepper from the Citizens Alliance of Pennsylvania. Leo, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
The city of Pittsburgh is struggling to deal with a large number of abandoned properties, as are other cities across the Commonwealth. Frank Gamrat and Eric Montardi explain the problem and talk about solutions on this Allegheny Institute Report.
Hello and welcome to the Allegheny Institute Report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal. I'm your host, Frank Gamrat, and with me today is Allegheny Institute Research Director Eric Montardi. Today we'll talk about a topic that I think affects a lot of municipalities and cities across the Commonwealth, and that is, what do you do with city or municipally owned properties? A lot of times these things sit there. They're not paying any property taxes. In some cases, they're a burden on the municipality or the city who has to trim the weeds or pick up the trash and make sure that it's not being a blight on the community. And so recently, the city of Pittsburgh had an issue come up where someone who worked for the city bought some property at a pretty nice little discount, and it caused some uproar, and the city controller released a report looking at the process of selling city properties. And Eric, you wrote about this controller's report. Could you please tell our listeners what you found?
The process is a long and sometimes convoluted one.
In the city. I'm shocked.
Not in the city. There's a lot of players involved. First, you have the actual city department, so the city of Pittsburgh treasurer, which is the head of the finance department, and they have a division there that is, you know, handles property sales. Then you have the Urban Redevelopment Authority, which is separate from the city of Pittsburgh. Its board is appointed by the mayor of Pittsburgh, and they're involved with development and redevelopment. They're a very heavy player in city property sales, tax delinquent sales. And then you have city council itself, the policy-making body. When you go through this long, convoluted process and you say, I found a piece of property that the city owns or is tax delinquent, and I'm interested in buying it, and I've been approved, and it goes through everything, it goes up in front of city council, they have the ultimate veto power. They can say, no, we don't want to sell that to you. So there's a lot of players involved in this. And basically what this performance audit found and made these recommendations of, there's 44 in total, found that there's got to be an easier way to do, especially the ones that the city owned. Because again, what you have is you have something called a treasurer sale, and that handles tax delinquent properties. So tax delinquent means that the city taxes haven't paid for at least 1 year. They don't count the current year taxes, or there's some delinquency on water and sewer bills. And then that can go through a treasurer sale. And basically, you can have private parties or community development corporations or even other governments can say, we want, you know, such and such property put into a treasurer sale. That process even goes through a big correction, I guess, what you want to call it. I mean, if you look at 2017, there was close to 2,000 properties that were put into treasurer sales. When they go through them and find out, okay, these are actually eligible to be sold, that fell almost by half. Then you go through the actual treasure sale. They schedule these things, I think, three times a year. I think in 2017 they did four because there was a lot more properties. It's only 59 that were sold. So we started out close to 2,000, and then you find out that, you know, only 59 of them get sold, and you're assuming at that point that the back taxes have been settled up, and now this going forward is not an issue with delinquency. If they move through that process, then they go into something called city-owned property sales. And in 2017, there was 175 of those properties sold. So they're technically owned by the city. Like, they have the deeds. They're not paying taxes. They're not delinquent on taxes. They're just exempt because the city owns them. There's 175 of those sold. As of the time that we did this brief based on the performance audit, so in October, there's 2,005 parcels listed at city-owned properties on this website that the city has. And when you go to look at them, they say, well, I might be interested in buying a vacant lot or a property that has a home on it and fixing it up. The price isn't even listed. It's to be determined because you have to go then, be vetted, goes to the URA. Again, there's that player that's coming into the process to say, okay, this is what the price of the property will be. And then by that point, there could be people that just walk away from it. They're not interested anymore. Maybe they just go and buy another piece of property that, you know, the city doesn't own or some other entity doesn't own.
Right. You get into the red tape of all of this. And of course, the ultimate goal, of course, is to get these properties back on the tax rolls so that they can be paying taxes and contributing to this city and not just a blight in a neighborhood. And of course, if you make it too complex, then you scare people away. If you make it too easy, then people complain that there's favoritism involved. And you, of course, you walk that fine line. So what were some of the recommendations from the audit? There were 44 recommendations in total. Which ones jumped out at you?
Boy, there was three, 32, 33, and 34. We're not going to use the historical numbers here for those.
Sure, we can.
Those three talk about quarterly public auctions. And that means that the city would take the city-owned property, again, the stuff that would be listed on this website, some of these 2,005 parcels currently, and basically each quarter set up somewhere in the city county building and say, this is what we're auctioning off. We're trying to get these to the highest bidder. As the controller said, what they want to do is try to sell these for the highest price that the city can get and get them back on the tax rolls, as you mentioned earlier. Get the inventory smaller. so that these things are back in the hands of people who are paying taxes on it. Now, why these three recommendations jumped out is because over the years, and especially when the city was in financial distress and state oversight, we made similar recommendations. Mm-hmm. If we go back to 2003, we said that the city should just auction off a portion of the property it owns. And again, we're not talking about like the city-county building.
Right.
We're talking about these vacant lots, these lots that have homes on them, side yards that are adjacent to other properties that people might be interested in buying, because they're not really producing any type of tax payments, but it's also they're not like related to the core mm-hmm. function of the city government. And that's the other thing about the URA is a lot of these parcels they have held for themselves.
Right.
You know, they don't put the prices on the website, and then it'll turn out some of these have been held for like decades that right. the URA says
because eventually they want to redevelop it, but we don't know when.
We
don't have any idea. Right. When don't we're know think when about it.
And for what purpose? You know, what project that they want to work on? 2 years later, when we did blueprint for the incoming mayoral administration, said again, take an inventory of the city's property, see what they have, and go ahead and auction them off. Just again, at the time when we were talking about, if you think back to 2005 with Act 47, all the tax shifting, all the changes that were coming to city taxes and saying, well, we have too much tax-exempt mm-hmm. property. The universities and the hospitals aren't paying anything. Commuters are only paying an occupational privilege tax. This was something that said, you have control of this property. Right. You can do something with it and see if you can move it. And then finally in 2009, we said, again, the city should begin packaging these properties, auction them off. So those three recommendations out of those 44 that the performance audit made really jumped out at us because those are the things that we had said in decades prior.
Right. This is a problem, like I said, doesn't just affect the city of Pittsburgh. I'm sure Philadelphia has its issues, as does Erie, Allentown, Scranton, et cetera. This is something that comes up a lot, especially in the older cities where the density of houses was tremendous. And over the years, the houses either decay or knocked down or whatnot, and you're left with these empty lots. So this is something that, of course, we've been on since the beginning, and we will continue to monitor as the years go on, and hopefully more resolution comes to these properties. I would like to thank my colleague Eric for joining me today. I would like to thank our listeners for tuning in. If you'd like more information on this or any other topics, please visit our website at AlleghenyInstitute.org. Thank you.
Telemedicine and allowing nurses and other practitioners to perform more services are ways to expand healthcare coverage to underserved areas. So says Ashley Klingensmith of Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania, on this Lincoln Radio Journal commentary.
Reimagining healthcare means seeing the supply of medical care increased through the removal of barriers to innovations like telehealth and full practice authority. Reforms such as these will result in a healthcare system that empowers more Americans to live long and healthy lives by relentlessly innovating to provide better care at a lower cost. Under this supply-side system, healthcare providers are free to compete and offer the best healthcare products and services at the best prices that meet the needs of patients. Unfortunately, some laws prevent healthcare providers from delivering high-quality and inexpensive care. Here in Pennsylvania, we have the sixth largest percentage of the population over 65 years of age, and we have 142 medically underserved areas across the state. With more Pennsylvanians needing more health care, we should change course to ensure a future where health care is abundant, high quality, and affordable. We can achieve this outcome through two channels. Let's discuss telemedicine. Telemedicine is an umbrella term for telecommunication technologies healthcare providers offer to remotely diagnose, treat, and monitor patients around the country. Telemedicine ensures that families, especially individuals that reside in underserved rural and urban communities, can access healthcare in a timely manner when medical providers are not readily available. If patients cannot remotely access telemedicine services, they will have to wait longer, travel farther, and pay more for the healthcare that they need. Although many healthcare services could be delivered through telemedicine, Many states impose a variety of barriers on providers who seek to remotely deliver care to patients. For example, many states require that patients meet with a doctor in person before they can receive remote consultations. Some states mandate that patients receive virtual consultations at specific locations, such as a hospital or rural health clinic, which prevents them from receiving consultations at home. These restrictions have significantly contributed to the growing physician shortage communities face around the country. According to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, nearly 80 million Americans live in communities facing a physician shortage. Here in Pennsylvania, House Bill 15, sponsored by Representative Reed Shaw, and Senate Bill 857, sponsored by Senator Vogel, address telemedicine. They would ensure that Pennsylvania law would apply equally to telemedicine-delivered care when care is remotely delivered by PA-licensed providers. Now let's discuss full practice authority. Full practice authority is an umbrella term for the range of laws and regulations that authorize advanced practice registered nurses, or APRNs, physicians' assistants, PAs, and other mid-level providers to practice medicine to the full extent of their education and accreditations. Under full practice authority, these providers can independently evaluate patients, deliver procedures, and prescribe medications, including controlled substances, under the exclusive governance of a state's Board of Nursing. This regulatory system increases the supply of primary and specialty care, especially in underserved communities that lack a reliable supply of physicians. Although all APRNs are educated and trained to independently provide all these services, many states deny nurses full practice authority and restrict or prohibit them from delivering care to patients. Here in Pennsylvania, Senate Bill 25, which modernizes scope of practice for nurse practitioners, sponsored by Senator Bartolotta, has passed the Senate nearly unanimously and now is in the House Professional Licensure Committee. We're working alongside a coalition to ensure it is sent to Governor Wolf's desk in the near future after successful navigation through the House. We know that the creation of a single-payer system or expansion of existing government-run healthcare programs will have a profoundly negative fiscal and healthcare impact. Instead, supply-based reforms such as telehealth and full practice authority for nurse practitioners should be championed by those in the legislature and in the medical field. To find us on Facebook, search at PAAFP, and on Twitter by searching at AFP Pennsylvania. I'm Ashley Klingensmith, State Director for Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 24 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WKFB-AM in Gannett, WKHB-FM in Irwin, along with WPHB-AM in Phillipsburg, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations. They include the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, and the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.